Afternoon. So, last time, we, after doing some review of sort of virtual memory generally, looked at things that XV6 in particular did. We talked about XV6's general memory layout, that when a program was running, how did XV6 decide to set up the virtual addresses? And we saw that we had this scheme where the top half of the virtual addresses were stuff for the kernel, and the bottom half was the stuff that a program we actually run would use. And part of the reason for this is that, well, we wouldn't change the mapping from these virtual addresses to physical addresses when we had an exception happen, so the kernel needed to be loaded. And also, it turned out we wanted a convenient way of accessing a particular physical address from the kernel for doing things like setting up page tables. So we had this one-to-one mapping that was set up at boot, or when we created a process of these high virtual addresses that would only be accessible in kernel mode to physical addresses. So that was sort of our overall memory layout. And we looked at how XV6 actually managed the page table entries, how it set up page tables for programs. We've started by focusing on sort of two key utility functions. So one called walkPageDir, which, given some address that the program would access and a first level page table, what XV6 often calls a page directory, would give us a pointer to the second level page table entry that actually contains the physical address of the page that the program will end up accessing. And by using this function is how we can do things like change where, part of the mapping down here points, because we can get the page table entry that represents where this page maps to here, and we could, edit that page table entry to point somewhere else. And we saw an example of doing this in another utility function's map pages, which calls walkPageDir and does precisely that. It sets a range of these page table entries it retrieves in order to set up a new mapping to some contiguous range of physical pages. Now, as far as what these page table entries look like, we looked at the format which was chosen by the processor designer. So XV6 didn't really get a say in what this format was, just Intel decided on it, and that's what they have to use. But it had some convenient attributes. And one convenient attribute is that in a page table entry, the top 20 bits were the physical page number, and this is the same way physical addresses are laid out. In the physical address in 32-bit XV6, the top 20 bits are the physical page number. And if the top 20 bits of the page table entry were the physical page number, then what were the rest of the bits? Well, they were used for what I called flags, so metadata, like, is this page actually present, or is it something that should cause something like a seg fault if you access it? Is it writable? Is it accessible outside the kernel? And in order to construct the page table entry, because of this layout, we could take the address as a byte address, the location of the first byte of the page, and OR it together with the flags we want to set that metadata to construct a page table entry. And this is, in fact, exactly what map pages ends up doing. So we're going to finish up looking at, well, now that we know about sort of these basic utility functions for setting up page table entries, we're going to look at the process of, like, actually starting a program. And a missing piece, which is, well, how do we actually get pages in the first place? Like, we have to assign a physical page to a program. How do we choose what one to use? We'll get that next. But before we get on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so questions about the last few questions on the quiz, which indeed people seem to have a lot of trouble with, which I was hoping I would have avoided with going over walkPageDir and so on in lecture. So let's start with question 3 here. So we tell you in the setup for this that we have a page table, and I tell you about part of the page tables for a process. And this must be telling you about the second level page tables, because we're telling you, the virtual page number overall, which must be at the last level, maps to something in particular. And I ask, well, where is the second level page table entry for this virtual address? So our first step is to divide this virtual address up into the two pieces we use for the lookup of that mapping. And we separate out the virtual page number from the page offset, because what we're going to do is we're going to take the page offset and we're going to use that last. After we get the second level page table entry, we're going to get a physical page number from there, combine it with the page offset. And this question doesn't actually ask us to do that last step. This question is asking just before that last step, where do we get a second level page table entry? And that we're going to eventually use with that page offset, but we aren't talking about that last step. And to get a second level page table entry, well, we need to look at the first level first. And if you remember how we ended up splitting up our addresses for 32-bit x86, the top 10 bits of the 32-bit address we used to decide what index in the first level table. And that means that, if our first level table, which we're told starts at this address, is there, we must have an index of 0. So the entry we're going to use there is the first one, the one at this address, which we're told in the question gives physical page number 43 hex. So if it's page number 43 hex, then we need to think of, okay, so that page is going to be our second level page table. So that's where the second level page table is. But the question isn't asking for the second level page table. It's asking for the second level page table entry. So it's asking not where is that whole table, where it's asking what part of that table are we actually looking at. And we have address with virtual page number 1. And remember that the minimum possible virtual page number is 0. And if we think of the bits we're going to use in that second level, that's the second 10 bits. And if we expand this to 32 bits, the first 10 bits were all zeros. The second 10 bits in this case is 1. So we're going to access index 1. The lowest index was 0. So it's not going to be at the beginning of this page where the second level page table is found, which would be option E. It's going to be 4 bytes later. Why 4 bytes? Because page table entries are 4 bytes. So if we skipped only 1 byte, we'd be in the middle of a page table entry, and that wouldn't be very useful. So that's on question 3. So questions about that? Okay, so a question on terminology. So I say here that when I say a virtual page number maps to a physical page number, would it be different than saying it references a physical page? So the reason I don't use the term references a physical page is because I usually think of the entry page table entry as referencing it because it contains that address. But the virtual page number, when you access it, it actually accesses this physical page, which is why I use the term maps for that rather than references, though I think references wouldn't be incorrect. So questions about my explanation for question 3? Okay. So then on the last question. So this question is about how walk pager works. And this call to walk pager is asking, if a program using this first level page table tried to access this address, what second level page table entry would be used? So it's doing the equivalent of finding this location, but not for this virtual address, 1234, but for this one, 3000. And that's going to be the one for virtual page 3. And we get that page table entry, we get a not the entry as a copy of it, we get a pointer to it. And we change what that pointer points to. We change the value in that pointer points to, which means we're changing the page table entry. And we're changing it to this value here. And if you remember what I mentioned going over what we covered last time as far as the page table format, the top bits of the page table entry are the physical page number. So this thing here, which has the bottom 12 bits all zeros, because these three zeros, and has the top 20 bits of hex 1, 2, that's going to be our physical page number. It's going to be this 0x12. And we OR that, we could have also added, would have been the same thing, with these flag bits, which specify the metadata for the page. And in this case, we're specifying the P, U, and W flags. And if you look up what those are, that's present, user mode, and writable. Though we don't actually ask about that down here. And since we retrieved the page table entry for virtual page 3, and we changed the physical page number in it to 12, that's going to mean that if a program actually ran after this using this page table, when it tried to access virtual page 3, it would end up going accessing physical page 12. Or 1, 2, I should say, because it's not decimal. So WalkPager returns the address of the page table entry. Yes, it returns, WalkPager returns the address of the second level page table entry. Other questions about this last question here? Can I explain how this address, how did I get virtual page 3 from this 0x3000? So we know that pages are 4 kilobytes, which is 2 to the 12 bytes. And that means that if we take an address, we're going to split it up into a 12-bit page offset, and the rest of the address is going to be our page number. And the last 12 bits of this address are these three zeros here. So everything left over is this page number. So a question, when do we use the top 20 bits versus the top 10 bits? So when we're thinking about page numbers overall, that's going to be everything left over when we take out the page offset, which ends up on 32-bit x86 being the top 20 bits. When we have to look inside a particular page table at a single level, well, we don't make our page tables big enough for that whole 20 bits, because that would be 2 to the 20 entries. So in this case, we've chosen to make them only have 1,024 entries. This is a decision Intel made. You'd have to look up what that size would be for, say, a different processor. And because it's 1,024 entries, we need 10 bits to get the index into those 1,024 entries. Other follow-ups? Other questions about how this works? So also had a question about question one. So in question one, I said that, oh, we could have a deadlock in this code here if we called it for the same student, but sort of two opposite courses, C1 to C2, this change course for students. So we changed from C1 to C2 and from C2 to C1 for the same student. And remember, when we talked about our definition for deadlock, we needed some circular weighting. And that's the big thing we need to look out for, which is going to help us, eliminate answers and also determine that this answer is going to be a problem. So let's start with A, the correct choice here, something which can happen. it can be the case that we can acquire the from course lock in this first thread and acquire, which is we for C1, and do the same thing in the second thread and acquire it for C2. And after we do that, you know, if they both do that in perfect sync, we just get lucky or unlucky, depending on your point of view. Then when they try to acquire their next lock, they're both trying to acquire locks that each other need. So that's how we get the scenario in A. So as for why is the scenario in B not possible? So in order for us to be waiting on the lock for C1, and also holding the lock for S, we would need to have gotten the lock for the student earlier. So the problem is that, you know, is that if someone has the lock for the student, they already have all the course locks they need to proceed. So if someone has the lock for S here, they can make progress, so there's no deadlock. And as for why they both can't be waiting for the lock for C2, well, if they're both waiting for the lock, then that would mean that none of them have the lock. And if these are the only threads, you know, that, you know, are going to cause our deadlock, then that's not going to be a deadlock scenario. One of them should get the lock. You know, if there is a deadlock, it's not caused by these two calls. It's caused by something else. Does that answer the question about this deadlock? So a question on follow-up for, is it possible for this to be true if S1 and S2 have out-of-order course vectors? So because we're talking about the change course for students functions, the order of the courses vector here doesn't matter because we aren't actually locking based on that order. If we were, then that might be a concern. So question follow-up, how did I get the second level, how do I extract any information about second level page tables from this virtual address? So I will probably draw this out here. It's probably useful to have a diagram. So if we have this address 0x1234, remember how our addresses are going to be split up where we have a page offset, and since this is a virtual address, a virtual page number. And that virtual page number is split into two halves. So we have the second level index and the first level index. And if we map this address to the sizes of these, which we can look up based on what our processor says they do, so this is just the sizes that x86 32-bit has chosen, we know that this is 10, 10, and 12 bits. If we map that to this number, adding leading zeros that I just didn't bother to write, but we know are always there, I find out that we have 2, 3, 4 as this part, and this is going to be 1, and this is going to be 0. So that's how I determine the index at each level, and using that information, I figured out where the second level table was by looking at the index at the first level, and where in the second level table the entry was by looking at the index in the second level. Is that a clearer explanation of that, how I used the address for that third question? Follow-ups, things that are still confusing? Okay, so that's a bunch on the quiz, but Yeah, seems like worth going over those last questions because, yes, definitely a lot of confusion, and it will help on the upcoming assignment. So previously we went over these two utility functions, this walk pager and map pages, and we're going to talk a bit about how we actually, you know, use these to like load a program at sort of a high level. And there are two big functions involved. So one is called allocKVM, and this, remember, sets up the high part of the page table mapping. So remember I said that in our mapping that the high half of the addresses are kernel only and have this one-to-one mapping. And this is set up separately for each process, and the allocKVM function sets up this half of the page tables, and it's basically just a bunch of map pages calls. So it's calls to this set of range of page table entries functions for a bunch of addresses up here. As for the actual user part of the memory, well, this is going to be different for every process, and there's a function to do this called allocUVM. So this sets up user memory, and it also is basically just a bunch of calls to map pages, but we want to give a unused physical page for each thing the user wants. So like when we want to load a user program, we don't want to load it somewhere that another program's already using. So this handles allocating space for the user memory. And to do that, we're going to use this kalloc function, which allocates a physical page. We already saw that function extremely briefly when we talked about walk pager making a second level page table, like if you ask it to allocate one. But that's also how we're going to allocate, say, space for the user stack or to load the user program's code into. And there's also a corresponding function we won't talk about much, deallocUVM, which basically undoes what allocUVM does, which actually doesn't come up very much, but except on program exiting. But we need to do that. So let's look at allocUVM. So here's most of the code. So this might remind you very much of what MapPages does, is that this is a loop where we have a virtual address in the variable A, which is determined based on old size. So allocUVM always does this thing where, you know, we assume the process starts at address 0, and we have some previously allocated space, and we want to allocate more space, and allocUVM is going to allocate the space between old size and new size. So it iterates through each page in this range, so hence this plus page size. And it calls kalloc to get a page that no one's using. It sets that page to all zeros, so the program starts up in a nice way, and also so we don't accidentally like read things we're not supposed to from other programs. And then it just calls map pages to say, make this address valid in this page table and make it point to the new page I allocated. Kalloc returns a pointer to the address in the, you know, that upper region of memory. And we actually need the physical address of that, which is why we use V2P here. And sort of that's our loop. So there's a question, what happens if one of these functions, allocUVM or allocKVM, can't allocate enough memory? We can see what happens here when allocUVM runs out of memory is that it prints a message that it ran out of memory, and it calls deallocUVM, so it tries to deallocate the program's memory to clean up, to like free up some space that it allocated in earlier iterations of this loop, and then it returns. And the same is true if MapPages fails, because we can't allocate a new second level page table to point to the memory we just allocated. And when this returns zero, the function that you were using to call allocUVM, like exec or fork or similar, will fail. So there's a question, why is the PG roundup needed? So let's say our new size here. You know, let's say this green arrow, this is our new size. And let's say that it's in the middle of a page. We're going to actually allocate the whole page. So we're going to get this extra space above that size for free. So this means that if the old size is in the middle of a page, that this would have happened in the previous call to alloc UVM. Therefore, we know that we don't actually, you know, the next time that this function is called, we don't actually need to allocate this extra space. And this roundup is reflecting that. It's going to round up to the next page because we know if the old size is in the middle of the page, that whole page must be allocated. And the reason we know the whole page is going to be allocated is because, well, we can't usefully map less than a page to a program because when we set one page table entry, that allocates 4 kilobytes. We can't do less. Okay. Other questions? So the question is, why is K-free and dealloc necessary if it already failed? So when you have sort of one of your programs fail, you're used to, my program goes away and all that memory that my program is using gets deallocated. But this doesn't happen for free. So in order to actually make when this allocating memory for a program doesn't work, not leak memory on the system, we need to actually explicitly deallocate that memory so later on we can use it for something else. Otherwise, if you tried to start a program and didn't have enough space to do that, you'd end up in the situation where the memory that was used in the attempt to start the program that failed would never be available for anything else. Okay. Other questions? So question, why are new size and old size swapped in the dealloc? So the dealloc UVM function takes the same arguments, old and new, but we want to go not from the new size to the old size instead of the other way around. Because we're undoing what we may have done. So question, given that this is an error, why do we return 0? Alloc UVM returns something else in the case where it's not an error. I don't actually remember what it is. I think it's either the old or new size. Other questions? Okay, so we have this mysterious k-alloc function, so it's worth talking about how that works. So k-alloc and k-free are the physical memory allocator, and this only allocates whole pages, and that makes this actually a fairly simple thing. And the way it works is it has a linked list. You might say, well, how do we allocate space for the linked list? And the answer is, well, if we aren't using a page yet, if it could be allocated, we just use the memory of that page to store a node of the linked list. So the nodes of the linked list are the free pages. And when we allocate a page, we remove the first node of that linked list and return it. And instead of using it as a linked list node, we use it to store, say, a program's data. And when we free a page, we add it to the list. So, and that's how it allocates. And the extra step is that we need to create this at boot. So basically, there's a loop that runs at boot, which for all the pages after where the kernel's data is loaded at boot, it calls k-free to add it to this list. So then we can, after that, call k-alloc to get one of these pages off the linked list. K Hey, alloc works with a linked list, so let's talk about program allocation. So when we start a program, sort of alloc UVM will be called to allocate this space here. And there's this heap thing, though. So this is sort of dynamically allocated. So the question might be, how is this allocated? And you might say, well, then maybe there's a malloc system call, but there isn't. So there's a much simpler interface for how a program allocates space on the heap. And there's a system call that called sbreak. And what sbreak controls is this size. So the program in XV6's process control block, we store this size, which is the sort of extent of the program's memory. And XV6 has chosen that if a program has a particular size, the addresses the program has allocated are zero to size inclusive. Or I guess size exclusive, because it's what? Just the end. And the sbreak system call adjusts this size. And if you adjust the size to here, that's going to allocate new space. If you adjust the size lower, that's going to deallocate space. So calling sbreak not only changes the size variable, but also calls alloc UVM or dealloc UVM to actually change the page table entries, so you can use that new space, or you free up that space that you're no longer using. And if you call malloc, you might say, well, how does that work? Well, malloc is a library function that's implemented by calling sbreak to get space. So it calls sbreak and divvies up that space as it decides to. And like, when you're implementing something like malloc, there's these considerations about, like, you know, how can I call sbreak to get a whole page and then split that page up if I'm, you know, my malloc call is only asking for like 16 bytes. But as the OS, we're not concerned about that. All we're going to be asked for is, please make the heap bigger or make it smaller. So that's heap works. So you can look, in fact, at the source of sbreak. So here's what it does. It takes an integer argument n, and it passes it to this growproc function. And it returns the old top of the heap. So it tells you where the old top of the heap is. So if you want to find your current size, you can call sbreak 0 is going to be your current size. And there's this growproc function, which grows or shrinks the heap. And what does that look like? Well, it just calls alloc UVM or dealloc UVM. And after it's done, it calls the switch UVM function, which just resets the page table so the processor knows, hey, the page table changed. So the reason this is necessary is that this is going to, you know, flush processor caches. We'll talk about that a little later in addition. Okay, so that's heap allocation and deallocation. So questions about that? And okay, and you can see here, there's a question earlier about alloc UVM's return value. So it returns the new size or zero on an error. And the same with dealloc UVM. So the question is, what does n represent in growproc? This is the number of bytes to extend the heap by. Or if it's negative, number of bytes to the negative number of bytes to contract the heap by. So that's allocation. So talked about sort of normal cases for accessing memory and changing page table entries. let's talk a bit about what happens if we access memory we're not supposed to. So if a page table entry is marked as not present, which I'll often call invalid, that triggers in the hardware something known as a page fault, a type of exception. And traditionally, we're kind of used to this resulting in, on like a Unix system, a segmentation fault message. You might say, so what happens in XV6? So in XV6, let's say I do this obviously invalid access where I just have chosen an address where probably nothing's allocated and I'm trying to assign to it. If I run that in XV6, this is going to trigger an exception, and it's going to go to the exception handler in trap, in trap.c, and it's going to run this code, which is going to end up killing my program. And I'll get a message like this. And this message is just actually a generic message for, there's some exception that I didn't know what it was, so I'm going to kill the program because I don't know what to do about that. So right now, XV6 doesn't do anything special. It treats a page fault the same sort of way it treats a divide by zero. And this message actually has a bunch of useful information. So it has this trap number. This is the ID given to the processor for this type of exception. It happens that on x86, they've chosen number 14 for a page fault, the type of exception when you access a non-present page. It also retrieves from control 2, which is control register 2, the address that triggered the page fault. So the processor, to allow OSs to do things that are maybe more useful with these page faults, stores the address that the program was trying to access. So this is obviously useful for debugging. Like if you are implementing a debugger, you'd want to have this number. And it's going to be useful for some other things we'll talk about in a bit, where we don't have to crash the program when a page fault happens. So we have that address. We also have the sort of the PC value, which is called, or the instruction pointer value, that of the instruction that was doing this move into this bogus address. And there's some other information here, which comes from the processor, this error 6. 6 actually tells us that it's a write if we look up in the processor manual what the error code value means. So right now, what XV6 is doing is just marking the program to be killed and printing out this message. But we could imagine doing something more useful. And in fact, many OSs, probably most OSs, have a page fault handler that doesn't just crash programs, even though, you know, this may not be your impression because you think, oh, segmentation faults, that's what happens when I access bad page table entries. But it turns out we often access bad page table entries, but the OSs kind of hide that this is happening from us, and they do some sort of just-in-time update of the program's memory. So sort of the code for this is sort of pseudocode, might look like when a page fault happens, rather than printing out that generic message, we say, okay, we have a page fault. Let's figure out what address the program was trying to access. And rather than, you know, assuming just because the page table says it's a bad address, let's see if we have information that lets us know that, you know, I think it's okay as the OS, even though I haven't set up the page table entry for it yet. And if I think it's okay as the OS, well, what I can do is I can say, okay, I just forgot to set up the page table entry earlier. Let's do that now. And I can return from this exception. And as a convenience to operating systems that want to do this sort of change the page table entry to make it better, when I return from this exception, the processor will retry the instruction that was doing the bogus memory access, and this time it might work. And if I don't think the address was okay, I'm going to do the same thing I did before and just kill the program, say, hey, this address wasn't okay. So there's a question, how could it have forgot to set a page table entry? You know, well, it couldn't have, but rather than forgetting to set a page table entry, we're going to just delay setting a page table entry. And sort of the advantage of this is that we can, you know, not do things until we know they're necessary. And we'll look at some specific examples, and those are actually going to be in our next assignment, our paging protection assignment. So since we're talking about this idea that, oh, we're going to change a page table entry, just some last little pieces of notes about how that works. So when we change page table entries, we need to do something that tells the processor about this if it has the page table entry cache. So we're used to never worrying about processor caches. Like if I change a memory location, even in a multi-threaded program with multiple cores, I don't think I need to worry about telling the processor that I made that change. It's going to figure it out. But page table entry changes are different. The processor relies on the OS telling it when a page table entry it might have cache has changed. In 32-bit x86, typically the way this works is you reload the page table base register. You say, here's the page table base register, even though it's the same as the old one, and the processor will say, okay, well, you must be telling me this because you want me to, you know, reload it, and it will do that for you. And so we saw this actually earlier in GrowProc here, where it calls the switch UVM because it wants to tell the processor, hey, I just changed the page table for this current program. Please reload it. And this would also be something which would come up in this function here, assuming we might be accessing something that's cached. Okay. So that's sort of something that we're going to have to do to, you know, do this trick of, you know, setting up a page table entry, you know, that might replace something that, you know, doesn't work. And we'll see some examples of that next when we're talking about why would we want to do this? And sort of the key idea is that we can have a difference between what processes think they have in memory and their actual memory. That the OS can decide, I'm going to let the process think I've allocated everything in this way, but I'm not actually going to do that yet. I'll do it later. And how will I do it later? Well, when the page fault happens, because there's this disagreement, I'll fix it so the process doesn't know better. As a concrete example, let's think about stack. So if we think about writing a program that has lots of recursion, we might want to have a stack that's like, you know, maybe megabytes, right? If you think of like, I want to have this big recursive, you know, Ackerman or whatever goes 100 levels deep, want to allocate, you know, a couple megabytes of stack. But a typical program, you know, doesn't actually use a couple megabytes of stack. It uses like maybe like 12K or something. So one idea we might have is, couldn't we just only allocate the space the program actually uses? And, you know, this extra space here that I have in blue, let's not allocate that unless the program actually tries to use it. And so we can kind of just allocate this space here on demand. And sort of why we would do this is that we're going to bet that, you know, the program is either never going to need the space, or that at the least we can delay allocating it until later and start the program more quickly. And this idea is actually very common in OSs. OSs will commonly only allocate space as the program uses it because it's often faster. So as for how this might look sort of more concretely, so let's say here I have my stack pointer. It points, it's in, this is the VPN of this address, and here's sort of what my page table looks like. I have this VPN is mapped to something here, and I'm about to push something on the stack. Remember, our stack grows down. So when I push something on the stack, it's going to want to go in this page. And as far as the processor is concerned, that memory is invalid. So this is would be, it's not, as in not present, So when I run this push instruction, well, that's going to cause a page fault. Because the hardware is going to look at this page table, this second level page table entry here, and it's going to say, well, that's not present. It's not valid. And it's going to ask the OS what to do. And if we have a page fault handler that doesn't just say, well, the hardware said it was bad, so I'm going to kill the program, the OS can say instead, oh, well, I didn't allocate space there, but I promised the program I would give it a megabyte of stack. And that's in that megabyte of stack. So that should be fine. Let me just make that work by setting this page table entry that the processor was looking for. So now it's there. And then I'm going to return, and the processor is going to rerun this push instruction here. But this time, because before we return to the processor, you know, back to the program, we set up this page table entry, this time it's going to work. So questions about this sort of allocating on demand idea and what the page fault handler is doing? So a question is, wouldn't the push not go into the next page? So push's semantics are that it sets the stack pointer to the stack pointer minus 8 and then stores in memory at the new stack pointer the value. So since our original stack pointer was this value, when we subtract 8, we end up with a value which is going to be BFF8, which is going to be in VPN 7FFFE. Other questions? So the question is, how does it rerun the instruction? Does the instruction pointer just stay on push queue? Yes. So the processor, to help us do this, will arrange for the instruction pointer to point to the instruction that failed, and also to make sure that that instruction didn't have any partial effects. So in this example, for example, when the page fault handler runs, the stack pointer will still have the old value before the push ran. So we can safely rerun it. And the processor is going to do a lot of extra work to make this possible for us. Yeah, so this is a big, you know, hardware support that's going to help our OS do this. Other questions? Okay. So, as I mentioned, this is very common for OSs to do, and often with pretty much everything a program allocates. They'll just allocate the space on demand. They won't actually, when the program starts, you know, set up the program's whole memory. They'll just make a page table that's mostly invalid and wait till the program tries to use the memory. And why would you do this? Well, it starts programs faster. Programs don't typically use all their memory right away. And, you know, that's just faster. And our paging protection assignment, one of the things we're going to have you do is allocate the heap in this way. So you're going to add a, rather than calling out, having alloc UVM, which maps those pages right away when we change the size of the heap, you're going to wait for the program to try to access, you know, the actual heap space that it was allocated, and then assign the space to the program. Okay, so since we have this allocate on demand idea, let's think about, let's say I have here a loop that accesses this array. Let's say our stack is allocated in this way. How much space will actually be allocated? Note that we aren't actually accessing the whole array. We're accessing every 16K, you know, about 16,000th element. Give another 10 seconds or so. So the first thing I wanted to look at is how many iterations do we have? We have 8 iterations here. So 128 divided by 16. And so we're only actually accessing 8 bytes. But we can't just allocate 8 bytes to the program. And the reason why is that if you remember what we did in this example here, is that when the program tried to access an 8-byte value, we needed to change a page table entry that allocates 4 kilobytes. And once we set that page table entry, we're giving the program 4 kilobytes. We can't make it less than that. We can't have the program pinky promise not to use the rest of it. No, it's all accessible to the program. So each one of these accesses that if it's accessing something that isn't allocated is going to allocate 4 bytes. And these are spaced out. So the first one's at index 0, the second one's at index 16K. So these are going to be on different pages. So if we allocate a page for index 0, that's going to allocate index 0 through 495, assuming this starts at the beginning of a page. And we access index 16K, that's going to allocate another page that's indexes 16K through 20K, because we have to allocate a whole page. And the same thing is going to happen for each of the other accesses. In no case are we going to be on the same page twice. If we had different indices, that would happen, but not with this spacing. So the answer I get is that each of these 8 accesses allocates 4K, so we get a total of 32 kilobytes. Questions on how I figured that out? Other things that were confusing about this? So a question is, I thought the stack could only go up to one page in XV6. So yes. So this code would not work in XV6 because XV6 doesn't allocate enough space for the stack. But this is assuming we are in a system where we have both a large stack and one that's allocated on demand. Okay. So question is, XV6 doesn't do on-demand allocation? Yes, it does not. XV6 allocates everything immediately. Doesn't do either of the page table tricks we'll be talking about today. Speaking of other page table tricks, so the other one trick we're going to talk about is something that's really handy for implementing fork. So fork creates a copy of an entire program. And this seems actually really wasteful, because usually what we do after creating that copy is we call execv and throw away most of the copy. And this seems really slow too, because we're like copying the whole thing. But there's a trick we can use. So if we think of bash, our shell, so this is a standard shell in Linux, when it calls fork, well, we have a new copy of bash. And we don't actually need to copy everything here. So if we think of our code here, we can share this between the two versions without making a copy because it's read-only. But it seems like that trick only works for this sort of code, which doesn't change, but doesn't work for like global variables and the stack and the heap. But we can make a trick here, which is that we can share this read-only, and it's fine until there's a modification. That we could share all this data, all these global variables, and just guess that probably they're not going to change, as long as we have some sort of fallback if the program actually tries to change something here in either of the child or the parent process. And we have a way of doing that. We can say, okay, yeah, we have a copy, but actually we just have the same thing, but it's read-only. And the processor is going to tell us, hey, this program tried to access this page and write to it, and you told me it couldn't write there. And we can say, oh, yeah, I did, but I told them they couldn't write there because I need to do something special to make that write work. And what's that special thing? We're going to make the copy when the program tries to do a write. So how would this look? So here, let's say I have my copy of Bash before it forks. When we fork, rather than making a copy of this page table, allocating new physical pages for everything, I'm going to have my parent and my child have two initially identical page tables where everything is marked as read-only. And, well, then the child or the parent is going to run and it's going to try to write something. So let's say the child tries to write to this virtual page. At this time, we're going to say, okay, well, now the child needs a different version of this page than the parent has. So at this point, we're going to actually make a copy. And to do that, we're going to allocate a new page, you know, so new memory, make the copy and mark it as writable because, well, now this is something that only the child has, not the parent. And here I've shown us doing it for when the child accesses something. We'll apply the same sort of idea when the parent accesses something. So questions about this copy on write idea? So a question is, can't this go writable, you know, after this operation? Yes. So we could make this writable now. Now, or we could wait till the parent tries to use it. And most commonly, OSs choose the second option, where they won't make this writable right away, but if the parent tries to write to this address, they'll do some look up in their bookkeeping data structure and figure out, oh, this is the only one process is using this page right now. I can just mark it as writable without copying. Does that answer that question? Okay. Other questions, comments? So this is very much like allocate on demand, but this is copy on demand. So rather than copying at fork, we're going to set things as read-only and copy later when we actually need an independent copy. Before that, we're going to let the program share the same version of things, which is fine as long as they're actually the same, as they're not changed. So let's do an exercise this. So let's say I have this memory layout, and we have 4K pages. So this is here, this is two pages. This is VPN 1 and 2. And we have one page of global variables, VPN 3. I have one page of heap, which is VPN 4, and one page of stack. And I'm saying, this is the process before it forks. It calls fork, and then the child does a write to the heap and the stack. And I'm asking, after that happens, how much memory do we actually have allocated to support both of these programs? And before fork, we had 5 pages. And note that immediately after fork, we also had exactly 5 pages. It's just that we had to handle these writes. We actually need the child and parent to have a different version of one or more of the pages. give another 20 seconds or so. Looks like we have pretty good consensus here. At least among people who are responding quickly. Is the heap one or two pages? Oh, the heap should be two pages. So I miscounted. Good work, me. Which means I probably misled people as far as the answer. And it should be two pages because these are two different virtual page numbers, but I read quickly. So thank you for pointing that out. Okay. So let me go through. So with my miscounting, most people arrived at the answer of seven. If I didn't miscount, we'd get slightly different answer. So the way I look at this is that, so we had actually six pages, because I can count because this is two pages. And this heap array, there are two possibilities. So possibility one is that this requires changing one page, copying one page, and possibility two is it requires copying two pages. So why would it be one versus two pages? If we think about our heap here, it's split across virtual page four and five, and the heap array could either be entirely in one of those two pages, or it could be sort of spanning two of them. And we can only copy a whole page at a time. So depending on which of these scenarios, this overwrite will either require making a copy for the child of just page four or just page five, or both, depending on exactly where that array is. And then for modifying a variable in the stack, well, that's going to be another page. So we're going to have, so our answer is six pages, the original, plus two or three, depending on where the heap array is. Seems like most people chose seven based on my miscounting, which would be five plus two, which makes sense. So questions on how I arrived at this answer? So, as I alluded to, we're going to have you implement allocate on demand for the heap in XP6, and also we're going to have you implement copy on write. So, for allocate on demand, what we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, we have this size of the heap, and rather than every time we change that, we actually allocate memory, we're just going to have you change the size and allocate the memory on a page fault. So your page fault handler is going to say, okay, is the program trying to access something that's less than the size? In that case, allocate that page. Otherwise, you know, if the program is trying to access something greater than the size, do what we already do, which is kill the program. Okay. And we're also going to have you implement copy on write. So in copy on write, you're going to implement this thing where we, when our program forks, you know, rather than fork making a copy, which is what current XV6 does, we're just going to mark things as read-only and give the parent and child, you know, two identical page tables. We aren't actually going to have the same page table for the parent and child because we want it to be the case that when we make this change here, that it changes just the child, not the parent also. And after we set up the page table that way, you know, we have to handle a fault from the write, which will also be a page fault, but it will be a page fault not because there's an invalid, not present page table entry, but because, you know, it's read-only. In that case, we're either going to make a copy or we're just going to realize, oh, wait a moment, I already made a copy of the other copy of this. Let's just make it right. So questions on allocate on demand or copy on write? So the question is, if this is the top of the heap, what if someone wants to write additional data to the heap? In that case, they must call sbreak to tell the OS, hey, I want to make the heap bigger. A question, and the size doesn't include kernel memory? Yes. So if we think of our program layout, we have zero to size. This is the user part, and then we have the kernel memory above that. And question, does this mean that we are going to need another copy of the original page table in case that page wasn't writable in the first place? So when we have a page fault, what we can do is we can look up the page table entry to figure out, so in XV6, this is easier because all the user pages are going to be writable. In a OS where we had some read-only memory, we would need to have some metadata that lets us know what parts of memory are supposed to be read-only. And this is, in fact, what sort of more complicated OSs will do, is that they'll have a data structure that's not the page table that says what parts of memory are supposed to be read-only or writable and so on. Does that answer that question? Okay. And a question about this kernel mapping here. So if this kernel memory is part of the process's page table, does each process have its own? So we're going to have a separate page table, set of page table entries for each program for this part of memory, but it's all going to have the same mapping. So they're just going to be duplicated page tables. Okay. So finally, I'm going to talk about sort of how memory management works in sort of Unix-like OSs. I guess I can first take one question on this. So why did I split this into two cases? Couldn't we, in this first case, mark both as writable at the same time? So yes, but then you have to do the bookkeeping to find the other writable examples. And note that we could actually have more than two, because let's say we have a process forks and it forks again. In that case, we will have some pages that are shared between all three of these processes. So you could do that, but it's a lot of extra bookkeeping, so it's not how I'd recommend doing the assignment. Okay. So one other page table trick that Unix-like systems support is this operation where we can map a file to memory. So on Linux, you can open a file, say some file dot dot, and you can get this pointer that acts like it's the file. And I mean in a really strong way, that not only can you use this pointer to read from the file, you can use this pointer to modify the file. That I can, use this as an array of characters, modify byte 1000 of that array, and that actually changes the file. And this is something that's going to be enabled by that same sort of page fault idea. So I'll talk about sort of this interface, and then we'll talk about probably into next time about how this is implemented. So this mmap call, we can specify an address, a length, and some flags. And this address we actually generally won't use. This is sort of a hint as where I want the return value to be, but for the most part, you don't get to say. And we have this length, which is how much space we want to map. And the important thing is not the address we want to map, but the file we want to map. So we specify the file as a file descriptor. We can also specify where in that file we want to get as part of our memory. And we have these protection bits. So this specifies, do I want to read or write it or execute it? We can actually use this to load a program. And we have these flags. And these flags let us switch between two modes. So we have this shared mode where the effects look like what I showed here, where if we modify our mapping of the file, it modifies the actual file. Or we have this sort of private mode where it makes a copy, and this actually is going to use copy on write. And you might say, well, this seems like some sort of specialized functionality that's like sort of awfully specific to, you know, accessing files. But this is actually how Linux and many Unix-like OSs kind of manage their whole, you know, process memory. That they just consider a program's memory is a list of mmap calls that were made in the past. But you might say, wait a moment, most of a program's memory isn't like mapped to a file. Well, the way Linux handles this is it supports this idea of an anonymous mapping, so you can have a mapping where this file descriptor isn't used. Okay. And if you look at sort of a special file called this procselfmaps, so this is dumping for cat the list of mappings that is the Linux idea of what is cat's memory. And it just, so basically what Linux, you know, treats cat as is it says, well, we have the executable file is mapped to these virtual addresses with write, read, and executable permission as private, that copy on write. And you know, there's pieces of that, and we have its heap is similarly mapped as just an anonymous mapping. And this list of mappings is how Linux actually manages a program memory. So if you remember when we talked about like looking up, is the address okay, when we had a page fault, this is the address okay, the way Linux implements that is it looks up this list it maintains for a program and determines what's supposed to be in each part of memory. And we're going to look at next time, you know, how to handle that to actually, you know, manage the program's memory using this allocate on demand idea and this copy on write idea we just saw. Okay. That's where I'll leave off today. I'll take questions before I sign off.
So in this case, the heap is just like an anonymous file, and it thinks it's a file, but it's not really.
Yeah. So the heap is basically actually an anonymous file. So in fact, it's so much an anonymous file that we'll implement assigning a space on disk for it if we need to.
Okay. Oh yeah. Okay, that makes sense then. That it would use that because it also could allocate disk space if necessary.
Yeah. So if you've heard about swapping, this is sort of make everything just a swapping is just a special case of this where we need to make up a file, which we'll talk about briefly next time.
And can I ask a quick question on the defense class?
After I take questions on OS.
Okay, no problem.
Any other questions? Okay. Not seeing any, we'll stop.